Hey nerds, we understand you. Drop those controllers, lose the wizard hat, and ready your Cheetos. It's time for some hard-hitting talk about the movies, books, and games you love. So get ready, oh searcher of useless knowledge. It's time to step into the Geek Cave. Broadcasting from a top-secret and totally awesome hidden base, I'm Kent Harris, and here's Darren Wright, Justin White, and Chad Savage.
Hey everybody, and welcome to another scintillating episode of Geek Cave Podcast Movies. I'm Darren.
I'm Justin.
I'm supposed to be scintillating? I'm Chad. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the movie segment. We are brought to you by Shirtosaurus, digging up clothing from the past so you can look rad today with free shipping on all orders within the U.S., plus great t-shirt, sweater, and hoodie designs on everything geek chic. Whether you're a fan of old school gaming, anime, 80s cartoons, or something in between, find something for you at Shirtosaurus.com. Also brought to you by Gamefly, your destination for new and used video games, with membership options for every budget, plus their store carries Lego products and some of the most popular arcade one-up cabinets. Gamefly has thousands of titles you can keep as long as you want. When you're done, just send it back with the postage paid envelope for a new one, or keep it forever and pay a lot less than in-store prices. Sign up for a free 30-day trial right now using the link at geekcavepodcast.com. Also, you don't have to keep it forever. Like, you buy it, you can keep it for a while, and then if you want, you can sell it. You know,
yeah,
trade it in. You know, use it as a coaster at your mom's house. I don't know.
It's fair. It's yours.
Yeah.
Do it. Do what you want.
So, Justin, a couple of days ago, you said you'd been sick.
Have
you been? You've been feeling better? I mean,
yes.
Been able to have some social time in a responsible manner?
Yes.
Oh. Hit it! Pilot party! Pilot party!
Pilot party!
Welcome to Pilot Party, where I review an entire TV series based only on the first episode. Why only the first episode? Because after one episode, the NyQuil kicked in and it was sleepy time for Justin. Okay. Parental advisory.
Explicit lyrics.
The following Pilot Party contains references to sexual themes, and the reviewed show is rated TVMA. Again, parental advisory.
We will not be held responsible.
So, Jordan, okay, just pass up a couple of minutes.
Okay. Now that all the little ones are out of the room.
Or they should be.
Or they should be. Have you ever eaten a meal so good that you orgasm?
No.
Oh my God. I know what this
if
is.
If not, head down to Yukihiri's diner. This month we're looking at Food Wars.
Yes.
This show begins with a father and son cook-off. Jikuro has bested his son Soma 489 times in this particular cook-off. They each prepare the same meal, and a customer says which is better. This is observed by the viewing audience as orgasmic bliss. The customer in question, a young woman, blushes. Her legs rub together and her body tenses. Then she slumps back in her chair and exhales a satisfied breath, declaring that Jikuro was the winner once again. The other customers greedily consume the fried rice concoction and experience their own taste-gasm. The young woman tries to make it up to Soma by saying that his was good, too. He offers her his newest creation, fried peanut butter squid. She tries it and is repulsed. And we're greeted with the visual of a peanut butter-covered squid trying to, unsuccessfully, sexually commune with her. At which point, Soma and his dad argue over who's made the most disgusting dish. Then we get the opening credits.
This was before the opening credits.
Yeah. Yes.
Way to lead, guys.
At closing time, an urban life planner named Yeiko, comes in and offers to buy the restaurant. They've been trying to redevelop the area, but Yukihira's is the last holdout. They say that the other businesses in the area are having trouble and ask what would happen if they can't give the customers exactly what they want. Soma informs them that the restaurant would gracefully close its doors for good. He then tells them to leave. The next day, Soma comes home from school. His father is out on an errand and discovers that the meat and other foods have been trashed. Things have been thrown out of the refrigerator and onto the floor, spoiled milk and cream poured over everything. He rushes outside to see the front sign covered in paint. Then the urban life planner shows up. She just happens to be in the neighborhood. And she happens to want a meat dish, calling Soma's bluff from the day before, saying, you know, what if he can't get her what she wants? Soma dramatically dons his apron and shouts, "Order up!" What we see next is a glorious montage of chopping, dicing, steaming, sautéing, flambéing, and baking. When it's done, he presents a, quote, pseudo-pork roast. He just happened to have purchased some thick-cut bacon for breakfast, and he had wrapped that around potatoes. Refusing to eat it, Soma calls her bluff by insisting she try it. The smell is intoxicating. With trembling hands, she reaches for the fork, gently slides the food into her mouth, and is overwhelmed by its flavor. Her knees shake as the savory juices in each bite overflow into every corner of her mouth. Soma sees that she's enjoying it and describes every sensual step of the recipe. The urban planner says it doesn't count but she can't contain herself. She must have more inside of her. Reaching for another helping, Soma pulls the dish away, making her promise to leave them alone and never return. She finally relents when Soma threatens to just throw it away. She agrees to his terms and begs for more, desire and lust filling her quivering voice. Soma gives her what she's longing for, the juiciest meat dish she's ever tasted. Even her goons are overtaken by the intoxicating aroma. Suddenly, we have a four-way meal. Meat is being shoved into everybody's mouths. Clothes are flying off, and hungry bodies are drenched with delicious juices. They have become one with the savory meat they put inside them. As the foursome lay on the floor, covered in sweat and catching their breath, Soma stands over them and simply says, "You're welcome." Later, Soma's father returns and tells him that we're going to be closing the shop for a few years. A business venture has come up and he just can't pass it on. And Soma is sent to a cooking school, which he's insulted by. He's an amazing cook. Turns out the school in question is the best in the country with only a 10% graduation rate. The camera pans up from where Soma is standing, up to see a cloud-shrouded building atop a mountain. This show is fucking bonkers, y'all. I've seen my fair amount of anime, and it borders on hentai. It just barely doesn't cross the line. There's only partial nudity, but all the explicit bits are tastefully covered. But make no mistake, this is not for kids. That being said, the story is fun, the food looks amazing. Rarely am I horny, hungry after a show, but this time I needed some thick, juicy meat in my mouth ASAP. And if you want to watch something this off the wall and full of WTF-ness, I highly recommend it. Now for my prediction. Soma will fight his way through culinary school, defeating rivals and instructors alike, making his way to the dean, Guy Fieri.
Of course.
They'll battle it out food truck style. Wave after wave of food is prepared and dished out, sweat dripping off of them as they grind out their masterpieces. They show no mercy as people collapse around them, shaking with umami-filled bliss. Finally, Sensei Fieri is rocketed into Flavor Town on a bullet train. Soma, victorious, returns home and reopens the diner. It ends with the dad challenging him to one more cook-off. Soma accepts, and the credits roll. I give it... You know that feeling when you bite into a corn on the cob and the melted butter just drips down your chin and you don't care because your mouth is filled with sweet yet salty savory goodness? I give it 5 out of 5 of those.
All right.
Well, I certainly went on a journey.
And for those of you using the timestamps to navigate, welcome back.
All right. So next we're going to jump into the trailer park roundup. There's not a lot of trailers that have been out. I mean, there's a lot of things, but we've done a lot of them. And honestly, I need to do a better job of keeping records because I might have already done some of these. Anyway, The Cursed, a period horror movie that's leaning into either vampires or werewolves, but also looks exactly like the kind of movie that's going to subvert that and give us something completely different. Looks to be up Justin's, you know.
Yes, the wolf pyre.
Well, the idea
the wereman.
The horror movie that doesn't rely on gore.
I do enjoy those.
But on tone and atmosphere.
Yes, I do enjoy those.
Uncharted looks like the best video game that I'll never get to play. And that's a compliment. X, letter X.
Ah,
gonna give it to you.
A group of people planning to shoot an adult movie get caught in a scary movie. There's layers. See, layers. It's a movie in a movie. Uh-huh. Totally not porn. It's art.
Yeah.
Jackass Forever. How are these people not dead yet? Gasoline Alley. An ex-con looks like he's being framed for a bunch of murders, but he's played by neither Bruce Willis nor Luke Wilson, and so they're probably the bad guys. Blacklight, Liam Neeson taking the daring opportunity to do a reboot of Taken. Studio 666, the Foo Fighters play themselves in a haunted house movie. Looks killer.
I saw the trailer for this, and I was over the moon. I want to see this.
Last Looks. I don't know what this movie is trying to be. Mel Gibson as a drunk actor needs a private investigator for something, and hilarity ensues? Maybe.
Okay, but what about the movie?
Pinocchio, a true story.
Oh, shit. All
right, guys. A cartoon Pinocchio... This movie has voice acting so bad that not a single person in the trailer sounds interested in what they're doing. That includes the voice actor for Pinocchio, who is one 53-year-old Pauly Shore. The tornado has run through this alley, and we end with a Pauly Shore-voiced Pinocchio, a true story... That looks and sounds bad.
Okay.
So instead, I'd like to draw your attention to our 4R conversation. There are a lot of shows out there that live in the memories of TV land. Some of them are given new life, and some lie encased in concrete within a nuclear waste bunker. This segment of the show asked you about one such forgotten piece of television history and asks, should we review it? It was good then. The original's just as good now. Reboot. The idea is sound, but needs to be modernized and recapture some magic. Revive. What are these characters doing after a couple of decades of growth and development? And refuse. Chad, this is like serving spaghetti with yogurt. We've done a lot of time travel over this the past 3 days here. And so now I'm going to bring you on my own little trip. long ago, the long, long ago of Sunday, April the 26th, 1991. School tomorrow has us kind of bummed. So what could possibly raise our spirits? How about a show that began in the mind of one Jim Henson? Now, Jim Henson's been deceased for a year at this point, but his creations endure. And that Sunday, with a gong and a driving drum beat, we're treated to the voice of the mighty Megalosaurus, Earl Sneed Sinclair, announcing, "Honey, I'm home." Let's give a bit of memory to Dinosaurs, a family sitcom featuring the Sinclair family and a slice of prehistoric life. Set in the year 60,000,003 B.C., Earl works for the We Say So Corporation as a tree pusher. His wife, Fran, runs the household. Their three children, Robbie, Charlene, and Baby. Baby Sinclair adds some comedy and drama. The show was unafraid of network interference because as long as the baby hit the dad in the head with a frying pan, they could overlook everything else. Dinosaurs was a show that touched on topical issues continuously, from environmentalism to drug abuse, racism, peer pressure, even corporate crime. But always the family is at the center of the show, and all the topics tie back to them in some way. This, by the way, had the most serious series finale of the time, when it ended with the onset of the Ice Age caused by an environmental disaster. So what say you, gentlemen? Review, reboot, revive, or refuse?
Oh, sorry, I'm running through the theme song in my head.
I think the show is, frankly, criminally underrated. You know, we people don't talk about it enough. It's everyone talked about the Muppet Show. Everyone talks about Fraggle Rock. But this show really did so many things right, from the puppetry involved to get the dinos to look, you know, I mean, obviously they didn't look like real dinos, but they looked like what you would get if you crossed a human with a dino, you know. Comedy nowadays is maybe a little hit or miss, you know, with the slapstick. But like Chad said, the network wanted what the network wanted. And the show, while it was a big downer in my mind, ended perfectly. So and seeing how Disney has handled some of its other properties after buying them, don't fucking touch this show. You leave it alone. Rewatch it, absolutely. But I don't trust Hollywood to do anything good with it if they touch it. So just review in this case.
I agree with Darren. Review. You cannot capture that kind of lightning in a bottle a second time. So there's no sense rebooting it. You can't. They're dinosaurs. You can't revive the series because they're extinct.
Yeah, don't Denver the Last Dinosaur this thing, okay?
So, and absolutely do not refuse this. This is absolutely worth a watch.
It's must see.
With such wonderful catchphrases as, "Not the mama!"
Yeah.
Favorite character in this had to have been the newscaster. He was very Walter Cronkite, but he was the only one, well, not the only one, he was one of the very few characters that didn't have a full body thing. So most of the characters, they had like 3-4 puppeteers needing to work these things all at once. Howard Hand Up Me did not. It just...
I liked, everybody goes for Baby, but I like the grandma.
Oh, Ethel?
Yes.
No, not Ethel, was it?
I don't remember her name, but she reminded me of the grandma from Family Matters.
Ethel Hinkleman Phillips.
There you go.
Yep.
Because the dinosaurs were all named after different like oil companies. Because it was all thought at the time that that's where oil came from, was from dinosaurs. And so you
had the Sinclairs.
The Sinclairs. You had Phillips, Ethel Phillips. Then you had Hess and Richfield, you know, and so on and so forth. So it just kept on going. So, yeah, it's a review. I have all four seasons of this. You can watch all four seasons now, I believe, on Disney Plus. Right now. So,
I occasionally, that show will just randomly pop into my head just for no reason.
And once you get past the first, I think it's two or three episodes, you can watch them in any order. Just turn them on. It had the same kind of, we're going to do two or three episodes in a row to give you a context. But after that,
see
it. It's funny. It's silly. It's well done. It has aspects of it that you'll watch now and be like, I think we've grown. But, you know, that is literally everything. Literally everything. Except for maybe a couple of old Charlie Chaplin movies. And that's just because there were like three people in it and they didn't say anything.
That's true.
That's fair.
All right. On to some reviews. Netflix, The House. The House is an anthology movie. You know, it's a 90-minute long movie. Spans three different stories across three different times, each one, you know, half hour long. Three different casts, but everything having to do with the same house. This thing is weird. Like, I thought My Life as a Zucchini was strange. This thing's off the rails. All right. Story one sees a poor family make a deal to move into a nice big home, only for the mother and father to start turning into furniture and then burn to death. The second story has a rat trying to develop and sell the home, but then everyone turns into insects and wrecks the place. And then the third story, the home is owned by a cat in a post-apocalyptic floodland who's trying to fix it up, only for the house to eventually turn into a boat and sail away to a sequel, I guess. It's weird. And it's supposed to be a comedy, but it's just a little bit too dark to recommend in that way. So I'll tell you, if you really like the stop-motion style of the Fantastic Mr. Fox, go ahead and see it. But otherwise, man, it's a C-plus for me. It was just a little bit too on my fringe to really be able to dig into. As of today's recording, so this is January 28th for us, you know, the first three episodes of The Legend of Vox Machina has been released on Amazon Prime, featuring a new story for the first two episodes and guest starring David Tennant's voice. We're introduced to the D&D adventuring party Vox Machina as they take on a job on behalf of the city. Third episode begins a new arc that happened in the first campaign of Critical Role, but this is surprisingly accessible as a show. They've built it not as a D&D show, but as an adventure. And so it really works in that way. Now, for those who play D&D or those who are fans of the show Critical Role, I'm sure that there are a lot of Easter eggs and a lot of things that kind of fit in that really work. But like, I'm a D&D guy, but I haven't watched the Vox Machina, you know, Critical Role stuff. I still kept up just fine. And it's not like they're rolling dice at any points of this. Although when you watch it, you can kind of narrate in your head when they rolled low and when they rolled high. So, definitely a show for adults. Parents should be aware of that. There is plenty of foul language, lots of nudity, and more than a little bit of stylized blood. I'll give a graded review when the season's done, but for now, I'm interested, and I'm invested, and that ain't nothing. The other show that I watched just for kicks and grins was The Woman in the House Across from the Street from the Girl in the Window. Aside from being the Netflix series with the longest name, The Woman in the House Across the Street from the Girl in the Window is a murder mystery in 8 episodes, starring Kristen Bell exercising her mystery-solving chops again. Almost like a flash-forward of Veronica Mars. If, you know, Veronica has a real hard time and turns to, you know, pills and wine. But Bell's character, Anna, is 3 years beyond her child, Elizabeth, being murdered and her husband leaving her. So she is hopped up on meds and wine and suffers from hallucinations. What makes The Woman in the House Across the Street from the Girl in the Window a bit complicated is that she witnesses a murder across the street. But she hallucinates. So we don't know exactly if what she saw is what she saw until the end of the series. There's a bit of a comedic send-up on all this with references from Hitchcock to the movie Scream. But the pace is kind of slow, and they sacrifice an absurd number of casserole dishes in The Woman in the House Across the Street from the Girl in the Window. But
and the green rest rose.
But if you like the Hitchcock style of storytelling with the stylistic camera angles and the red herrings, give it a shot. It's a B-plus kind of thing. Once more, that is The Woman in the House Across the Street from the Girl in the Window. That is all the reviews I have. If there is nothing else.
Ooh.
Yeah, Darren.
Actually.
And now it is time for Darren's Trivial Trivia.
So, I noticed that recently you guys reviewed one of the Alien films in You Want Me to Watch What?
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Did you know that the Alien franchise actually has different androids in almost every installment, and their names are alphabetical?
Huh.
Yeah. Ash.
Mm-hmm.
Then Bishop. Then Call. Then David.
Huh.
Well, now you do.
Now I do.
Okay.
That is exactly the right amount of trivia. All right. Well, in that case, it's time for a random movie review. Kent?
Oh, the lights are down low. The popcorn is hot. The drinks are cold. Settle in for the cinematic universe of Chad's Random Movie Review.
By the roll of the dice, next month's random movie will be Going in Style. This month, however, I watched the critically acclaimed 1993 action suspense movie In the Line of Fire. This film sees Clint Eastwood as Agent Horrigan, who is the last surviving member of the Secret Service team that failed to protect Kennedy on a particularly important day in November. Since that time, Horrigan's been doing what the Secret Service was meant to do, stopping and preventing counterfeiting. After stopping one such counterfeiter, Horrigan and his partner look into a complaint from a landlady because she found a shrine to assassinations, specifically presidential assassinations. After securing a warrant, they go back to find all the pictures gone but one. A picture showing a young Clint Eastwood with JFK on the day of the assassination. Horrigan feels guilty because he didn't react fast enough to shield Kennedy in time to stop the second bullet, so drinking in guilt ended his marriage. That night, at home, Horrigan is doing both of those things, guilting and drinking, when he receives a phone call from the tenant of that creepy apartment, who identifies himself as Booth. Booth instead of Oswald, because Booth had panache, and this dude also wants to kill the president. He finds a kindred spirit in Horrigan because they were both betrayed by those around him, so the game is afoot. Horrigan gets himself back on presidential protective detail, despite his age, because it's a brilliant idea! I mean, really, you have a dude that's named a particular agent, told him his plans. He keeps calling that agent and making him part of things, so you put that guy next to the President of the United States. I'm pretty sure instead you ship that guy to Seattle to bust up a counterfeiting ring, and then tail him to find out who's contacting him. Oh, well. Anyway, it turns out that Booth is actually a former member of the CIA, because of course he is, and was an assassin for the government, because of course he was. That's the way these go. By the way, this is why when you finish with your assassins, you're supposed to just kill them, like the Joker does with Bob at the end of Batman.
That was his number one guy.
And he was done with him. And what did he do? And he made Bob give him his own gun.
Yeah, well, you know, don't waste bullets or anything.
Furthermore, the FBI ran the prints of this guy, the Booth, the assassin, after an incident with a car. They know the guy's CIA, but they won't tell the Secret Service. They'll tell the CIA, but the CIA won't tell the Secret Service. Y'all, lack of communication is the bane of healthy relationships, and a lack of transparency fosters distrust and paranoia. It's no wonder the president almost dies. I'm honestly surprised it doesn't happen more often if these movies are anything close to being true. Ah. So anyway, fast forward a little bit. Horrigan is doing all these things, and now he's got the flu. But he doesn't call in, because reasons. So when a balloon pops, he thinks it's a gunshot and overreacts. You know, maybe it's my experience of everything from March 2020 to the present and beyond, but this part of the movie just ticked me off. Stay the heck home, you contagious prick. Well, this overreaction means he's off protection detail because we have to have a good Act 2 ending for our hero to climb back from. Around about this time, things kind of become a blur. Booth has been setting up a bunch of bank accounts to donate to the presidential campaign so he can get a seat at a fancy dinner. At one of these, his story doesn't add up, so he has to kill one of the bank people in her home. And that's what Horrigan's going to connect these all things and ultimately get to the dinner in time to save the president's life. Now a big damn hero, he retires and goes on a date with another agent with whom he's been having a predatory and awfully awkward relationship with. So, confession time, guys. At about a half hour into this movie, I took my mouse and I went down to the bottom right of my Netflix screen where you can change the playback speed. And I set it for 1.5. See, in 1993, this movie was considered good. You know, his action, it's a bit of a How Ketchum kind of movie. I mean, the actors do their job. Eastwood does his gruff thing that he's been doing for nearly his whole career. John Malkovich nails the crazy assassin shtick because, of course, he does. Rene Russo's there, too, as the least believable character in the movie. And Dylan McDermott telegraphs his death so well that we see it coming from his first scene in the movie. I mean, it's brilliant. The terrible part, the movie's not bad. We've just outgrown it. Because it's not old enough to see the sexism running through it as quaint. It's not old enough for us to see the pursuing of his fellow agent as a romantic partner as anything close to cute. Honestly, we should have seen that as a parallel to Booth trying to kill the president. Like the way Eastwood, you know, pursues Rene Russo's character. And the way Booth pursues the president should have just been running in parallel to show that they're both kind of bad guys. And the only reason we root for one other than the other is because he represents some sort of order. The camera works fine. The script needs an overhaul. You could remake it today. It'd be a better movie. So, really, it's a don't be like me, in case you didn't gather that earlier. On that terrible disappointment, our continued thanks to our sponsor, Shirtosaurus and Gamefly. Yeah, you know what? You know how you could be like me? Check out our other podcasts. You want me to watch what? And week 3, found it just about every place you can find podcasts, including Good Pods, where you can pop onto YouTube and watch Geek Cave Plays and hopefully some Retromantics. So, for Kent Harris, our Mo, Darren Wright, our Larry, and Justin White, our Curly, I'm Chad Savage, a very confused Lou Costello. Thank you for listening, and remember, everyone is a geek for something.
Certainly. No.